Hello and welcome to the Atonicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy with my very even-handed and knowledgeable co-host, Kirsten Korosek of TechCrunch. Hello, Kirsten.
Hello.
And then we have the also very knowledgeable and very opinionated Edward Niedermeyer of The Drive. Hello, Edward.
Hey, Alex.
You didn't like that, Ed?
No, I love your introductions of me. They always get my day started off with a nice ego boost.
So today we have a wonderful guest. We have Philip Koopman, who I believe is a doctor. Is that right, Phil?
PhD, yeah.
PhD. And you are the co-founder of EdgeCase Research and one of the world's leading authorities on safety. Would that be fair to say?
I do my best. That's what I can say.
And we are here, or at least to talk about UL 4600, which is a very important thing you've been working on. But before we get to that, is it true that you have a connection to the movie The Hunt for Red October?
Fair enough. I have an indirect connection. The Navy officer who taught me how to use a periscope shows up in the movie as the mini sub driver. So back then, that's kind of what I was doing and when I was doing it, when I was a submarine officer in the U.S. Navy.
And what was your position on the boat?
Well, it varied. They rotate you through jobs, but when I actually got qualified in submarine warfare, I got my Gold Dolphins. One of my jobs for a while was I was in charge of the submarine from midnight to 6 a.m. and officer of the deck, making sure everything happened while the captain and XO were asleep.
So really, maybe I was wrong. Maybe the correct reference is Crimson Tide. And you were in the position of being the guy in the command room with the weapon, who the captain would say, remove so-and-so from the room, basically.
No, I was the guy on the periscope telling the ship what direction to go, basically running the ship while everyone was asleep. So Hunt for Red October works. It's the guy on the periscope saying, turn left, turn right, go up, go down. If need be, fire torpedoes. I was an attack boat, so we did not have the ballistic missiles.
Was it a 688 attack boat? Sorry, Kirsten.
Oh, heavens, no. It was an old boat from the 60s. It was a 594 class.
Like the Thresher that sank.
Well, that would be the 593, yes.
So you have a lot to say about points of failure and safety.
Well, when you sleep every night less than 100 feet from a nuclear reactor, you learn to take safety pretty seriously.
And this is how you got into what you do now. I mean, this seems like sort of a natural progression to go from that into road safety.
Well, that's one of the ways I got in. The other thing I did was I was a CPU designer back in my misspent youth. Actually, it was a lot of fun. I recommend it for a few years for anyone who's into that. But I moved on, and that CPU ended up looking at automotive applications. And then in yet another life, I got involved with roboticists, and they were worried about safety. So I keep running into safety over and over. And eventually, over time, I picked up a bunch of domains, and now I do safety most of the time.
But is your primary focus these days on autonomous vehicles and automotive in general, correct?
These days, I do self-driving car safety. That's what I tell people.
So what is it about, before we jump into UL 4600, that is so compelling to you? Because you've certainly done a number of different things in your lifespan. So is this something that's going to be short-lived, or is this where you plan on dedicating the rest of at least the next few years of your time and research and effort?
Well, I've been doing car safety for a while. In fact, I was doing self-driving car safety more than 20 years ago, back in the 90s. People don't necessarily know about this, but there was a whole big self-driving car demo in San Diego in, I think it was 97, in the late 90s, well before the DARPA Grand Challenge and all that happened. Self-driving cars were running around. And I was the safety guy in the CMU team, although back then we knew the software was pretty marginal. It was more worried about hardware redundancy, things like that. But then after that, I got into just general automotive safety in a number of ways. I've done it from the design side. I got involved in some high-profile litigation about vehicles that, you know, probably not as safe as they should have been. And so it's a natural progression. And right now, this is a really big topic. These things need to be safe if they're going to go on the road. And so I feel like I have the right skills at the right place at the right time, and I want to make a contribution there.
And when AVs did start to test on public roads, sort of, how did you feel about that? Did you feel like the at that point the technology was already ready, that the practices around testing on the road safely were good enough? Sort of talk about that because that was a big transition, right? Going from testing out in the desert and in closed courses and things like that to actually using these systems on the road. What was that transition like for you?
Well, I had an unusual path because I had access to some of the very early first things that were being operated on the road before most people even really knew this stuff was going on. And they were, you know, kind of scary. I would ask some questions about, well, is that big red button really work? And they'd say, oh, yeah. And I'd say, show me the hardware block diagram. And I'd go, you know, that big red button really isn't as safe as it needs to be. So I had a bunch of interactions. Things have gotten better. For sure, the companies I talk to, I know, have gotten better. Hopefully, everyone's sort of gotten with the program, but it's hard to know. So for me, the issue with the road testing is these things. I live in Pittsburgh. These things go by our office all day long. And the thing that bothers me is that I don't really know if they're safe, and I know that people can get it wrong because I've seen it. And so now here they are putting the public at some risk. We don't know how much, and we take their word that they got it right. I'd really rather see some more transparency so that when these guys are out on the road testing, that we have a good reason to believe that that they're really safe beyond trust us, we're smart.
How many companies have you more recently worked with in terms of looking at their, either looking at within the functionality of the vehicle or just their basic procedures and sort of reviewing those? I mean, how many have you advised, I guess?
I can't give you a straight answer because of all the thicket of NDAs. We've certainly talked to lots of companies. We've worked with first-tier suppliers. We've worked with military systems. We've actually even worked with folks that you probably wouldn't even consider as in this space, just doing safety of computer-based systems and safety of autonomy.
So Tesla?
not going to name names. and also I hear back. I teach a class at Carnegie Mellon in the fall, and a lot of those students end up working in these kind of projects. And every once in a while hear back about, you know, which companies are they had a better experience with. I'll just put it that way. So I have a pretty good visibility. And I think the industry as a whole, there's some folks who are really serious and really capable. And there are some folks who could improve. That's kind of where we are.
And you're not going to name names on today's episode?
Not going to name names.
Okay, but without naming names, right? Because naming names is fun and interesting. But like really what I'm curious about is what differentiates those two, right? Is it just that, you know, some groups of people are just smarter or more sensitive to it? Or like how does that difference play out in terms of practices, whether in terms of design of the systems or just maybe testing practices? Where is that line between the folks who are doing this safely and correctly and the folks who have room for improvement?
Yeah, fair enough. So I'm going to transition, just to be clear, I'm going to transition to talking about the actual self-driving car, not just the testing practices.
Yep, sure.
What you have is, I said I was doing this back in the 90s and people were working on it before then even. And there's lots of smart people who spent decades trying to get the technology to work, and it's starting to work pretty well. Technology demos that work pretty well are not to be mistaken for a product.
Right.
You know the old saying that the first 90% takes the first 90% of the time and the last 10% takes the other 90% of the time? Oh. You know, people are starting to wake up to that. And the things that make you an amazing robotics researcher and an amazing autonomy researcher have not that much overlap with the skill set needed to make a safe product. Safety is its own thing. And so you can have some really smart folks. In fact, the very smartest folks might sort of think, oh yeah, I can handle this, but nobody's smart enough to reinvent decades of knowledge about safety learned the hard way. You can't just go reinvent that. You have to go and figure out what other people have learned. So what I see, some of the better companies have figured this out. They're actually hiring safety professionals and they're sort of getting that capability in-house, which for many of these companies is kind of new. But the thing that's left out is no one's really done safety for autonomy before. So that's not something you can just go out and buy. You have to figure out how you're going to do it. And that's why this is such a big challenge.
And what do established safety experts bring to the design specifically of an autonomous vehicle? What are they drawing on and what are they providing that you can't just sort of be smart enough to figure out on your own without that experience?
Well, some of it is there's a huge corpus of standards. So ISO 26262 is one of them for it's called functional safety. And that's a standard that if you chose to use it, you could build cars that are conventional cars that are safe. There's an issue. Lots of companies don't use that. That's a different topic. We can come back to that. And so they sort of know how those standards work, and there are a bunch of practices. And the thing they also bring is a mindset. So most engineers, when they go through school, they're taught how to make things work. And that's what engineering school is about, how to make things work. Safety guys are not really interested in how they work so much as how they break. It's a different mindset. And so even the word safety, when folks use the word safety, ordinary folks, they mean something different than when safety people use that. So for ordinary folks, if you have a car that's driving down the street and it sees a pedestrian and it swerves around the pedestrian because it can't stop in time, people will say, oh, that proves our car safe. Well, yeah, you have to do that. But the safety folks they say, well, of course you did that, right? Let's talk about safety. How do you know it always saw the pedestrian? What happens if it didn't see the pedestrian? What happens if it hits an ice patch while it sees the pedestrian? They ask about all the what ifs about, sure, it's supposed to work, but does it really work? Does it do it all the time instead of most of the time? Because I don't think you really want a car that avoids kids in crosswalks most of the time.
Yeah. So I mean, this is to some extent, right? There's sort of the idea of being a feature complete system and sort of working towards that. And that's sort of that basic functionality. But then once you have that, then you start getting into stuff like, what is the failure mode for different parts of the system, right? This is sort of what you're talking about. Like if you lose, you know, your LiDAR or your camera or what have you, sort of how does the system respond to that failure? And what are its sort of fail safes in those sort of circumstances? Is that what you're talking about?
That's a part. That's a start. For traditional systems, that's the functional safety. You ask that. What if this breaks? What if the computer crashes? What if there's a single event upset that corrupts memory? What if the brakes don't work because there's been a hydraulic line failure? You ask all these questions. For autonomy, you need to go even further, because you could have a perfectly working system that just doesn't see the kid in the crosswalk because it's snowing and you're in Tempe, Arizona, and it didn't occur to you to worry about snow. It does snow there on rare occasion, I understand, but there are things like that. There's another standard, ISO 21448, safety of the intended function. People call it SOTIF. And that's sort of what that's about. It's, well, yeah, okay, so nothing broke. You covered all the failures. But what about the system just isn't working because of something you didn't think of?
Yeah.
So that's another safety standard that's out there that is supposed to address at least a piece of these autonomous systems. So I think you need more, which is why I'm working on the UL standard.
And just so we're clear, that 21448, that's brand new, right? That just came out. Is that right?
It's like a draft. Yeah, you can get it, but it's a past. It's basically a proposed standard. So it's the ink is basically still dry on that.
Okay.
I wanted to talk a bit about the differences between those two standards, and you sort of hinted at that. But before we do, I'm wondering, as you help or advise these different companies, is there a commonly overlooked feature or decision or procedure that you have noticed as a trend within, as you look at how they're approaching safety? Or is it all over the map and each company sort of misses a different thing?
Well, there's sort of stages. The first stage is people think you can just go out and drive around until you're safe. I don't even know that you can drive around until you're actually just working or mostly working, let alone safe. It just takes too many miles, billions and millions of miles. So the first stage they go through is just trying to get the thing driving most of the time for a few hundred miles without having a problem. Then when they realize eventually that that's not going to play out, you're going to need to do more than that, then they invest in simulation and things like this. And they find out that the problem is, well, you have this great simulation, but you have to keep the simulation fed. So you can have the world's best simulation, but if you didn't tell the simulation that kangaroos exist, you're not going to find out, like Volvo found out the hard way, that they had trouble with kangaroos because they jump and you assume that animals didn't jump and it messes everything up. So you get sort of there. But then eventually you still get diminishing returns, that when you can think as hard as you want, you can drive around 1 million miles, 2 million miles, and you're going to see a lot of weird stuff, but you're not going to see everything. So then people sort of go past that and say, well, what are we going to do about the stuff we didn't think of? Then you get projects like the Pegasus project in Germany, which is, let's, it's like Pokemon, got to go catch them all. all the possible scenarios and geometries and all the things that can happen. And even if you get that right, and SOTIF is sort of living in that area, even you get that right, what you then find is that avoiding the kid in the crosswalk only works if you can actually know it's a kid and know you're supposed to avoid it. So you have perception, which says, oh, that's not a bush, that's a person. And that person, I know that person's on the sidewalk, but he looks like he's going to step out in front of traffic because he's not waiting for a bus. There's a lot of intent recognition you have to do. And so you have to go beyond all the scenarios and say, hey, how do I know I'm going to see people? And what we found is that there's a lot of things that these systems fail at that might surprise you.
Like what?
Yeah.
Okay. Since you ask, since I tempted you into asking, some of the stuff we've seen. So we use an off the shelf academic style perception algorithm. So different vehicles are going to have different gaps, just to be clear, right? But the one that really jumps out at me that's kind of scary is that construction workers in yellow high visibility vests disappeared from this one system we tested.
Whoa.
Okay. Now, I had just bought a yellow raincoat. I'm reconsidering that purchase because I do live in Pittsburgh. And some of these guys might be using that. I don't know. But there's actually a reason for this, that you train the system to recognize people. And when you think of it, you're saying, all right, the cameras and the LiDAR and whatever, but let's just talk about cameras. The camera is going to tell me it's a person, but the camera does not tell you it's a person. The camera tells you it's something that looks like all the people I've already seen because it's based on training. So if you have a person who doesn't look like the people it's seen, it's not going to know it's a person. And how many people do you see driving around in yellow high visibility vests? Not a lot, especially if you avoid construction zones when you're driving because they're tricky to handle. So what you see is that things that you put on to be highly visible that make you look not like other people might be camouflage for these. Might. I said the word might. Mm. Now, hopefully the guys around Pittsburgh have figured this out and have trained on construction workers. But the next time there's some bizarre clothing style or bizarre hat style that makes you look a little different, you know, who knows what's going to happen? Those are the kind of things I worry about that go beyond the SOTIF stuff and the 26262 stuff.
How do you account?
Now, by the way, I should mention the SOTIF guys are working on a revision, but you know, no one's seen it yet. So
okay.
Just to be clear.
How do you account for, and this is something that I've thought about a lot over the years, but how do you account for the unknown factor? So the example you just gave was, you know, maybe a new funky fashion comes out that all of a sudden changes things and that person is unrecognizable or it's not coming up. So how does a company today account for protecting future fashion choices or whatever that change might be and ensuring that safety is consistent? Is it a matter of consistently updating a system to react, or is there a way to be more precautionary?
There's a bunch of ways to go at that, but that's actually a central issue behind UL 4600. So I'm working on the standard UL 4600, which is supposed to take the really big picture. And one of the things I spend a lot of time thinking about is dealing with these unknowns. So for example, if you're worried about pedestrians that look unusual, the first thing you want to do, and SOTIF would certainly encourage you to do this, is take as much data as you can and try and shrink down the gaps as far as you can. But the fact is there are going to be things you didn't think of the day you release, either because they're rare or you didn't think of them, or the world changes out from under you. Now you can say, well, we'll drive around and the first time we see, you know, a kid in a Halloween costume, because we didn't think of Halloween, it's always fun to take data on Halloween. We did that. It was entertaining. You know, we didn't think of Halloween. You know, we'll fix it. Well, you have to be sure you're not killing people between the time something weird changes in the environment and you fix it. So you have to do better than just say, well, we'll fix it when we see it. And so you have a combination of things where you say, first of all, we're paying attention. So if we have a near miss, when I do slideshows, I have a guy in a chicken suit, right? And it turns out that sometimes they see people in chicken suits and sometimes they don't, depending on the system and the picture. So if there's a guy in the chicken suit and he's in front of you and you don't see him, and the guy in the chicken suit jumps out of the way and you don't hit him, the good reaction for a company, it's called safety culture. A company with good safety culture doesn't say, huh, missed that guy, nothing to see here, let's drive on. The reaction is, oh, we didn't see that guy. We got lucky. We better fix that before we get unlucky. So that's part of it. And another part of it is always trying to measure the fragility of these systems. That machine learning-based perception is actually pretty fragile. If you put some noise in it, it often fails in pretty spectacular ways. So there, 4600 has a whole chapter on how to make an autonomy pipeline safer by a combination of all these techniques. But really, we're very aggressive in saying, if you see anything unusual in the field, even if nothing bad happened, you still have to fix it because you got lucky and you're not going to get lucky forever.
That still seems, though, a bit reactionary. And I don't know how you, I mean, it certainly is a good step, but how do you protect against what you haven't thought of before? It just seems like that is a fundamental risk that will always carry through with autonomous vehicles, is that whatever company has launched a robotaxi just didn't think of a scenario and hasn't encountered it yet. Is that a fundamental risk, or is there any way to protect against the stuff that we haven't thought about?
That's a fundamental risk that's never going to go away, but you can mitigate the risk. You can reduce the amount of likely damage. Remember, people aren't perfect. Now, if you ever want to go to the 94%, which is a complete misquote of the underlying data, you know, people are not as bad as some folks say. An unimpaired human driver is actually really good, but they're not perfect. So if you want your self-driving car to be as good as a human, it doesn't have to be perfect. But you're right, you can't just, I already said, you can't just wait for it to happen and say, we'll fix it. So there are actually a bunch of things you do. One is you have an extensive list of good practices, because if you're sloppy or incomplete in your data collection, you're starting out already down in the hole you dug, right? So you have to make sure you get all the accepted practices right. Beyond that, you actually have to make an argument why you're safe enough to deploy. It's not good enough to say, yeah, we thought everything we could, time to go out and drive and deploy. You really want to be more thorough. You want to say things like, okay, we thought of everything we could. We had 100 million miles of road data and we analyzed it. And by the way, when you say, we'll drive around and notice weird things, well, if it's something you haven't seen before, how do you know that it's weird and how do you know to look at it? It turns out that's a really hard problem. So you have to argue that you actually noticed all the weird things, that you got lucky and didn't hit the guy in the chicken suit or whatever it is. So you have to say, we looked hard and we have data that explains why we looked hard.
Are you saying that human annotation will be necessary forever?
Well, human annotation is expensive. And so one of the things, you know, In the startup company, and that's sort of a different story than UL 4600, but we actually work on tools that help with that situation. So you have to annotate, but what you can't afford to do is have a human annotate a billion miles. Just there aren't enough humans to do that. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a lot more clever than that.
And what can you talk about those tools?
Sure.
You can't come on a Tonicast, say you've got something you're working on, and then get into it.
This is a fascinating challenge. Right. I think you're absolutely right. And I'm really curious, like what?
So let me finish up the 4600 argument, because it's really important, and I'd be happy to come back and talk about the tools thing.
Perfect. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the 4600 argument is, you have this data and you're sure you actually extracted all the weird things out of it that are there to be found. And it better be a lot of data, you know, 1,000 miles of data. I'm sorry, that not even thanks for playing. You have to do better than that. But, you know, it might be 10 million miles. It might be 100 million miles. You have to have a story for why we should believe you have enough data to not be dangerous. All right. And then you have to make some argument about, and I'm going to give you some example arguments. I'm not going to say these are presumptively valid, but the kind of argument I might tend to make is, well, you know, we trained up our system and then we did this on-road testing with a human safety driver, which is important to get right. It's hard to get right, but it's important to get right. And every time the human safety driver noticed something weird, they pressed the button, the yellow button, the red button, whichever button it is. Again, different topic. And we went back and figured out what happened. But the important thing is not just that we fixed it. It's that first that was happening every 1,000 miles, then it's happening every 10,000 miles, then it's happening every million miles. So we have some confidence that it's not happening that often, part one. Part two, most of the time when something bad happened, the system knew that it didn't know what was going on and it safed itself without pressing the red button. So you're going to have to build these, I think, to address the concern about what about the stuff you didn't think of. You're going to have to build these systems to be pretty good at realizing, I don't know what's going on. I better do something safe. Humans are great at that. I've seen some bizarre stuff on the road. And most of the time, like, I don't know what's going on there, but I don't like the looks of it. You know, I'm not going, hey, there's a truck with a mattress flapping around on top. I'm thinking 10 feet behind it is a really bad place to be, right? You know, humans are pretty good at that kind of thing. And so if you have a system that you train to be very respectful about the limits of its abilities and know when it doesn't know, then you can do things like say, well, 999 times out of 1,000, when something bad went down, the car knew it was in trouble before the human had to intervene. Okay, now you can take the time between weird things happening and say, well, we've got a 99.9% chance that even if it's something we never saw before, that we'll get it right. So we get to take credit for that. So you have to build a safety argument. So UL4600 is all about safety cases. It's not an old school standard where you say use 18 gauge wire for your electrical system and 15 amp breakers and sheet metal that's 23,000 thick. It's not that kind of standard. It's more make an argument for why you're safe. We're safe because we thought of all these things, and here's how we know we didn't miss anything big, and here's how we're going to know if we miss something big, we'll find out about it later, and here's why if we miss something big and we find out about it later, probably it'll be a good outcome too. So it's an argumentation approach, and you have to take all these kind of things into account. So it's much more sophisticated than let's just drive around and see what happens. You have to be very thoughtful. It's otherwise known as good, rigorous engineering.
So Phil, so what you're saying is, even if we take every conceivable precaution that a self-driving car will have a crash, let's go back in time. Standards of
Hold on. I just argued that you're going to avoid almost all of them. I concede that it's going to have a crash. Some of them are going to be literally unavoidable.
Okay.
You can't. It turns out Newton was a really smart guy. And there's some things you just you can't beat. You know? And there's going to be some you can't avoid, although people tend to overinflate that. Actually, there's a lot of things you could avoid if you're on top of things. And there are going to be some things where it just makes a mistake, especially at first, till we learn. As long as that residual risk is on a par with human drivers, maybe it's okay to deploy these things. But you can't just say we're done. You have to keep paying attention to make them better over time.
So what happened with like the spectacular scandals of the past, the Toyota unattended acceleration, that passed every standard that existed at the time. So what happened? How did that go down at all?
That's an interesting statement. The standard it passed was Federal Motor Vehicle Safety, FMVSS. And that has to do with whether your brakes work and whether your taillights light up and your headlights and your turn signals. It has nothing to do with software safety, and to this day has nothing to do with whether the system is safe. Remember I said there's safe vehicle sort of does the right thing and safe doesn't really work?
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with the second bin. And to this day, there is nothing in the U.S. that really forces companies to do a good job writing their software. As long as you pull the headlights on and then they turn on, that's it. You're good to go. And so when they passed things like that, yeah, but that has nothing to do with software and computer safety, which was the crux of that case.
So, and to be clear, I mean, that's the case with autonomous drive systems too, right? I mean, if you have a system, so you say, for example, you're a hypothetical car company that has the ability to update software over the air and you have taken deposits on a full self-driving system. I know this is very hypothetical, but bear with me. And you want to push that system. You think it's ready, and you want to push that. I mean, there is no safety standard that it has to pass for to get sort of government approval to do that. Is that accurate?
It's close, but let me try and be precise about it.
Yeah.
You still have to pass FMVSS.
Right.
Although if you put out a software update, I don't know that anyone's checking. And I understand there was an issue with that hypothetical company that the brakes weren't braking as fast as they should be. And they got fixed, right?
Yep.
And the people, a lot of people said, look how cool software updates are. And the safety folks were saying, what do you mean they released an update that broke the brakes, right?
Right.
So it depends how you look at it, right? But there's more. It's important to know the whole system. Part of it is FMVSS. And it is a true statement that there's no requirement to follow a software safety standard. Most of these companies, all of them, to some degree, have internal engineering standards they use, but we don't have any visibility And in my experience, I've seen some of these standards. They're generally not where you'd want them to be. And they're generally not as rigorous as even the company would tell you before you got to see them. So there's an issue. Maybe they've gotten better lately, but you know, there's a potential issue there. And we're back to transparency. If there's no transparency, you can cut corners and get away with it. And there's always the pressure to get to market and cut some corners. And that's called being human and being in a capitalist society, right? So that's an issue. But going back beyond that, now if you have a bunch of wrecks and you kill a bunch of people, eventually NHTSA is going to come after you. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration is going to come after you and do an investigation and say, what's going on here? So there is on the back end, if you mess up your software, there's a possibility of an investigation by the government,
right,
and a recall. Historically, those recalls only tend to happen if the manufacturer is able to reproduce the fault. There are some extremely notable instances where people allege software problems. And NHTSA said, nope, nothing to see here. We drove it 1,000 miles, didn't happen again, so must be driver error. And then there's the whole litigation thing, right? So that's the system. Is the upfront is requirements to field are pretty minimal. They're just FMVSS. But on the back end, there's investigation, there's litigation, which is somewhat of a deterrent to bad behavior.
And so this the unintended acceleration case, weren't you a witness on that case?
Right. So this is the Toyota unintended acceleration case. So this all sort of got public around 2010. And there was a class action and there were death and injury cases. And I was an expert hired by plaintiffs in the class action and one or more death and injury cases. There was only ever one trial in Oklahoma City. And the result of that trial was that the jury blamed the computer system for death.
And what was the, I guess, organizational fallout from that at Toyota?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to see what happened inside Toyota. There were a whole bunch of death and injury cases that were settled. They're still happening, like 500.
Wait, they're still happening today?
I still get phone calls. Well, those vehicles are still on the road and I still get phone calls and emails. Now, whether or not what happened, who knows? But you know, the settlement process was still going on as of pretty recently. So that you know, the cars are on the road, there's still going to be complaints. But beyond that, you know, in later years, everything I've heard tells me that as a company, they've taken software safety very seriously since that event, which I think is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Just getting back to the regulatory question, I mean, it does 4600, UL 4600, is this a step towards creating a framework through which a government regulator might at some point be able to create an actual regulatory process where before a system is released to the public, that it can go through some sort of formal approval process? Is this setting that up, or is this just something very different than that? Is this just for internal use?
Well, that's not the main goal, to be clear. and you had a lot of ifs and maybes and some days in that question. So, yep. So let's take it that way. Let me sort of tell you what I have in mind. What's going on is right now, because it's not technology that's been around for 20 years, people can't sit down and say, let's write a standard. We all know how to do this. And the fact is people are still making this up as they go. It's a new technology. It's really exciting. It does impressive stuff. But if it's not safe, it's not going to be able to be deployed in any volume. That's going to be a problem. So we sat down, you know, at EdgeCase, we kept getting these customers wanting help with this kind of technology and saying, isn't there a standard we can follow? And we looked and looked, and there's a bunch of safety standards, but there's no standard that really does this. So I decided, hey, why not write one? Give it a shot, right? You know, I have nothing better to do with my life for a year. So that's not really true, but I decided to devote a bunch of months to writing this. And so I did that with UL. We chose UL. I can explain why we chose UL, that we can go into detail, but the short version is they do things a lot differently. And so the process is kind of interesting. We should come back to that. But to continue sort of this answer, what's going to happen is this is a voluntary standard. So industry gets to decide whether they want it to be accepted or to request changes. But UL, so the guys who, if you open your fridge, there's a sticker with a circle and a UL in it, those guys. They've been doing electrical system safety for more than 100 years. I think it's 125. They've been doing robot safety for a long time, software safety for a long time. They've been doing a lot of automotive work, but not doing cars, but rather doing pieces of cars and test equipment, stuff like that. So we got together with them and we have the standard that's going to come out. It's voluntary. People can follow it or not as they like. But if you want to follow it, a company like UL and potentially other companies as well will come in and externally say, yeah, you guys follow the standard. The word is conform. You guys conform to this standard. And that doesn't mean you're guaranteed to be 100% safe. It means you did a really good job engineering and you thought of all the stuff that we know of that matters. And you have a process in place, like I described earlier, to make sure that when stuff comes up, you'll handle it. So in principle, if a car company goes through that, they can put that sticker on their car. It's called the mark. They can put the UL mark on their car saying, hey, you should trust us as a consumer because we conform to the safety standard, just like the refrigerator you bought. I mean, that's where it sort of ends. Now, if a regulator might want to say, well, you know, if there's been adverse events and they want to put pressure on, they could say, all right, you have to conform to an accepted safety standard. Here's our list of acceptable safety standards, UL 4600, and maybe they put SODOF on, you know, they put whatever they want on, and they might just regulate, you have to conform to one, we don't care which. But the nice thing about the setup is the government is not in the business of doing the assessments, that there's a third party who exists solely to do assessments who's in there doing the digging rather than government employees. And that has a lot of advantages.
And it's also not prescriptive, right? So you're not going to get a case of, you know, people teach their system to the course.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the big changes, I mean, the other safety standards try, but UL 4600 goes a lot further. So the other safety standards will say you have to do process step one process. They'll say, here's the, you have to do an engineering process, do any engineering process you want, but it has to spit out the following pieces of paper in this format. And UL 4600 is much more general. It says, all right, give me a list of all the things that can go wrong. Now, by the way, we identify a dozen safety standards and each safety standard is a different way of giving you that list. We don't care. Pick one, pick two, have fun. Just give us the list. So it's very non-prescriptive that way.
I recall last year, Mobileye put out a white paper that was an attempt to address a safety standard for AVs. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that and does it address, how does it compare to UL 4600? I would assume that for UL 4600 is a much more robust, this was just a white paper compared to setting up an entire standard. But I'm wondering if there are any similarities between the two, if there's or if it's a completely different approach, that they're talking about.
Sure, I have to disclose that we just this morning got acceptance of a paper that I co-authored with someone in Intel who works with Mobileye, so I do have a conflict there.
Phil, if you had been asked that question yesterday, you would have said that they were full of shit.
No, actually, the paper points out some areas for improvement, but in fairness, they asked us to help them find things they can improve because, you know, everything I've seen about the RSS guys is they really want to make the world a safer place. And I respect that a lot. So I'm happy to help.
Are you sure they don't just want to move Mobileye?
Well, you're allowed to make the world a better place and have a business interest. I mean, I certainly have one too. Everyone has one, right?
Yeah. Sure.
So I think the RSS stuff does a piece. Remember I talked about you had to worry about all the, well, there's a car crossing and there's a kid in the crosswalk and it's good. You know, Newton was a smart guy, like I said before, and it's about applying that to making sure a car is not going to hit into things. And part of the standard says you should be using something, RSS as a candidate, you can use something else, whatever you want. So that's part of it. But there's so much more. You have to think about things like, all right, well, you have to move around, but there's the perception I talked about. But there's also a lot of lifecycle stuff. There's what if there's a maintenance error and a driver would have been able to deal with it, but you know, you can't deal with it. What if there's a bizarre, you know, a catastrophic loss of sensors? So Mobileye is about how far you have to keep away from the other cars. It doesn't talk about, I don't know, this happened to me, a giant blue tarp blew off a gravel truck and completely covered my car at highway speed. Oh, and it was a convertible, so it was literally in my face, right? And, you know, if I'd been going on cameras and LiDAR, I would have had a problem, right?
A big problem.
A big problem. Okay. Or the time the engine fell out of my car. Yes, stuff like this happens to me on a fairly regular basis. Oh,
And what do you drive now?
Okay. I drive a Volvo now.
And what did you drive previously?
I had a Acura RSX 2003, which is the year before they put the software into control engine speed. And I kept that one until it was ready to die. And I come up with, I'll tell the story because we're going to have fun. I come home and in my new Volvo, and my neighbor is like, oh, new car. It's like, why'd you buy a Volvo? And I said, well, you know, the nice people at Volvo flew me out to Gothenburg and I gave a talk I do about Toyota unintended acceleration because their safety people really care. They wanted to learn. And I got a spent up a day interviewing the designers and a day interviewing the safety folks. And I talked to the autonomy people and they really convinced me that a robust safety culture, which is the thing that really matters in the end, is people care about safety. They don't, right? They have a great safety culture. So I went home and bought a Volvo. And my neighbor looks at me like really weird, like I'd sprouted a second head and said, you know, Phil, most people just kick the tires.
That's really funny. I'm wondering, you know, I'm looking at a presentation here you gave, and you have a thing about architecting a safety envelope system, and it talks about having a machine learning based doer system and then a traditional software safety checker system. And I'm wondering if there's a broader issue here sort of around the safety of, you know, there's sort of a divide in the AV developing community between people who believe in sort of an end-to-end machine learning, you know, neural net approach versus people who sort of see that the need to keep that machine learning sort of focused on narrowly specific tasks within sort of a broader sort of traditional code framework. I'm wondering if from your perspective, the standard that you're developing and sort of your learning about safety, does that bring you down on one of these sides or the other? Or is that kind of irrelevant? You can do either one safely.
Well, if you're interested in a demo, you can argue end-to-end machine learning gets you there faster. Mm-hmm. But one of the big things is if you have a system that you haven't thought about safety from the first day, you end up, in my experience, almost always just throwing it away and starting over because you have to design safety in from the beginning. And with end-to-end machine learning, I just don't see how you do that. And so you're referring to the doer checker thing, which is where you have a machine learning thing that you don't really trust. And so you put a non-machine learning piece of computer hardware software built according to 26262 or something like that. You put this thing that you actually trust and it puts an envelope, puts it on a leash and says, all right, the machine learning can do whatever the heck it wants to optimize ride quality and fuel economy and do cool stuff. But if it crosses this line, we're cutting it off at the knees. In that case, your safety argument, so 4600 is about making a safety case, is, oh, the machine learning cannot possibly cause a bad result. So it doesn't have to be safe because we have this safety net in place. We have the safety envelope to keep a leash on it. And that works for most things except perception. Perception's harder, which is why we spend a lot of time doing tools and thinking about how to do that, which reminds me, I promised to get back to that, right?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So what we found, this is work that was originally done at Carnegie Mellon, and then now we do it at Edgecase, is that if you add a little bit of noise to a video image, things disappear. The person can see them, but they just disappear. So there's a guy in a yellow raincoat, and he just vanishes, right, when you add a little noise. And by noise, I think, you know, back in the day when there was broadcast TV, I'm dating myself, and you get some grainy noise because the signal was weak, right? or for modern folks, you have an image that's been compressed and decompressed and recompressed about 100 times. It's like, there's something in there, right? You know, that kind of thing. Mm. It's basically a sloppy, nasty image. And people disappear. And the initial reaction we had is, well, okay, so if people are randomly disappearing, we'll track them through. That's three hit. But it actually turned out to be more interesting than that. When we went from the university to the startup company, what we found was we took a bunch of data, we built a tool to do this called Hologram. So that's the tool I was talking about for perception safety. What we found was it isn't random failures, that if something disappears under noise, it is predictive of a gap in the training data. And it's also predictive of that a similar thing completely disappearing with no noise. So it's sort of like an accelerated life test. You can find, hey, you know what? Every time we see a guy in a yellow jacket, there's a good chance it'll drop out when we add noise. Let's sniff through. And so the tool actually sniffs through the database and finds things that, you know, here's a picture where the guy in the yellow jacket dropped out and there was no noise. And so this is a way of sort of predicting the holes in your training, even though the safety driver with the red button would have never tagged it because the vehicle saw him that time, but it almost did not see him.
That's really, really interesting. Yeah. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
So what is, I want to ask about some regulatory questions, but what, maybe we should focus a little bit more on UL 4600. So what is, now that it's done, and what is the trajectory of it now? I mean, is it, you sort of hinted at it before, which is the ideal scenarios for these, for standards like this to be really under the purview of third parties, and the federal government really doesn't get involved in vetting companies and ensuring that they stick to a standard. So how do you want things to move forward? Do you want the federal government to acknowledge UL 4600 as one of those accepted standards to for AV companies to have to hit, or is there some other scenario that would be ideal in your opinion?
I prefer carrots to sticks. We've invited the federal government to the table so they can watch the process, but you know, that's not the center of the show. Let me do a brief overview of what's really in 4600, because I sort of went at it from the safety case, but what it really is, it's designed to be, it's the draft single spaced is over 200 pages now. So there's a lot of stuff in there, but what it is, it's a long list of, did you think of that? You know, this is one of my new catchphrases. Did you think of that? You know, did you think of the guy in the yellow raincoat? Did you think of the blue tarp? Did you think of all these weird things that happen? But a lot of it is just known good practice from other standards, except applied across autonomy, and autonomy changes how you look at things. So some of it is you can extrapolation from existing standards, but some of it is when you have autonomy, things change. Things like you can no longer rely on a human driver to compensate. So in 26262, you get credit for, yeah, that'll happen, but a driver's going to handle that. Well, there's no driver. So now what's your plan? You have to have a plan. So some of it is, did you think of those kind of issues, implications of human? Some of it is just a list of good practices saying, here's a bunch of things that pretty much everyone agrees are a good idea. You need to do those. There's a bunch of things that might be a good idea depending. Please tell us that you considered them. If you don't want to do them, that's fine. But by the way, if you have an incident in the field that traces back later to not doing it, now you got to do it. Now you have to, you know, explain your reason for not doing it just went away. And that kind of feedback is really largely missing from the current standards. There's a list of bad practices, like single points of failure. We mentioned that before. Single point of failure is where you think you have two channels. You know, there's two computers, and if one breaks, the other one will take notice or take over. But it really, all of it goes through a single chip at one point, and if that thing breaks, you're done. So single points of failure, they're bad. So there's some bad practices. Don't make this mistake. And there's a bunch of safety war stories that people do safety know about. And it's like, did you make any of these classic mistakes? Learn the lessons. So it's a repository for lessons learned. There's feedback, and there's a lot of requirement for independence, because if you don't have someone independent doing checks and balances, it just doesn't work out well. So given all that, that's sort of the framework. I'd like the carrot approach. I'd like the car companies to realize that they're going to have to get this stuff safe, or there's not going to be a business. And these are just good practices to keep you safe with a lot of flexibility how you implement. And I'd rather see them just get on board and say, you know, you're right, we have to be safe. Those are all the good practices. Let's just do it. And if the car companies step up and do that, or especially the ones that value safety, they're in a position to say, look, we're following this standard. And if they want to try and raise the bar for everyone else who's cutting corners, you know, that's a very healthy social process. Maybe that's how regulation gets involved. I don't know. I'm not here to regulate. I'm here to try and make sure everyone knows what they should be doing.
I'm just letting it sink in for a moment.
Yeah, wow.
It's a couple hundred pages. Yeah. There's a lot to sink in.
Some light reading.
Will a draft of that be available publicly? Or?
Let me explain the process. The process is right now, as we're speaking, they're forming a thing called a standards technical panel. So I mentioned UL does things differently. If you're in a normal standards process like ISO or IEEE or IEC, any of those, the way they do it is they get a bunch of people in the room and they're supposed to write down what standard practice is. But if it's an evolving technology, there's a lot of debate and it takes years. So 26262 is more than 5 years between revisions. It's just a really long consensus process. And that's effective if the house isn't on fire and everyone knows what's going on and you're just trying to iterate to the next one. But for rapidly changing technology like this, that's a problem. So UL has a standards process that's dramatically different. What they do is they get a subject matter expert, in our case three, but I'm doing most of the lifting. They lock them in a room and they squeeze until a standard pops out. You know, that's the fun way of saying it. And I'm the guy they squeezed, right? So I'm here writing most of the standard. Uma Farrell, who's a certified FADR, so she does aircraft safety, wrote several of the sections. And Frank Fretrick, who has a lot of military system background, has been keeping us honest. But we're doing all the writing. UL is making it sound and look like a standard, although it will not look like any other UL standard anyone's ever seen. It'll be quite a bit different. And then when that's done, which we're pretty close to, we're within a couple of weeks of that being done, then it goes out to this STP, and these are invited stakeholders. So we're talking, you know, hopefully we'll have some. UL decides who's on. So the goal is to have some OEMs, some full stacks, some chip makers, some insurance companies, some regulators, some academics, at least one lawyer, some researchers. So really broad spectrum of the stakeholders, consumer support, consumer safety. You know, a really broad section of stakeholders who get to look at the standard and take shots, and they get to vote on the standard. If they don't like it, they're going to vote no, and we're going to have to change it. And so that becomes a process. And then when that committee worth, you know, 25, 30, 35 people, something like that, so big, but not really that big. If you just count up all the OEMs, not everyone gets to be on, right? Then when they're sort of happy-ish, then there's a bigger second circle of commenters who don't get to vote, but to get to comment. And by that, and that's how everyone who's interested gets to see a copy. And when all the comments are resolved, then it becomes a public standard. I'd like that to happen this calendar year. Everyone thinks I'm nuts, but I'd like it to happen this calendar year. And certainly it has to happen sooner rather than later, because this technology is going to deploy with or without a standard. And the world's going to be a better place if they're all doing the safe thing.
Yeah. I mean, I just kind of as a maybe a way to wrap this up, I'm really curious, since you look at safety so closely and you know, you noted at the beginning of the show that there are, you know, you can distinguish between folks who are doing things right from a safety perspective and people, you know, teams, companies, whatever, with room to improve. Are you, you know, I think one of the fears that I've heard from people talking to developers who feel like they're doing this the right way, the safe way, is that, you know, because there's so much incentive to cut corners and try and get ahead and deploy before everyone else, that there's this possible scenario that a company will cut corners, get out, you know, and start deploying early, or certainly develop the perception that they're in the lead, and they will thereby sort of contribute to horrific events. And maybe we've already seen some of this that end up impacting the entire sector, and that end up, you know, sort of punishing the people who have been taking the time to do this right. I'm wondering how optimistic are you that scenario can be avoided, or how pessimistic are you that we're going to see some pretty tragic or indefensible sort of things from the AV space in the future?
Well, there are some good actors and there's some actors who probably need to do better. And the existence of a standard at least sort of sets the bar for determining who's a good actor or not. You know, if you're following the standard, you're trying. And if you're blowing off the standard in really flagrant ways, you're not trying. The issue we have now is there's no transparency. It's really hard to tell who's who. And so if we don't change how things are done to sort of require one way or another industry pressure, whatever it is, you know, decent, reasonable safety practices, you know, that usually leads to bad outcomes. I think that the thing that's on fire now is actually before that. So the good news is now that everyone is finally coming around to realizing this is going to take longer than they thought, now it's harder for them to say, there's no time to be safe because we have to beat, you know, by the end of pick your favorite cure when somebody said they're going to deploy. Everyone knows it's going to take longer. So now there's time to do safety. And I'm seeing a bunch of companies actually doing that, saying, okay, we have time to do safety. Let's do safety. And I think that's great. But the thing that's on fire is not that. The thing that's on fire is road testing. And so if you have folks who are doing unsafe road testing, you know, we're potentially only one fatality away for the whole thing coming tumbling down. You know, it's there's not a lot going to be a lot of forgiveness for testing safety. And it's important to realize these testing platforms are not self-driving cars. They're test platforms supervised by a person. The way you get safety there is completely different. It's all about, is the safety driver paying attention? And are they going to be able to react in time and all these things, that which has nothing to do with whether the autonomy is working really. There's a very small overlap. And so I think what I'd like to see, this is not something I'm actively working on. I did write a paper to make a contribution, but it's not what I'm working on. I think the industry needs to get it together and come up with a road testing safety standard so that they can stay in business long enough to actually get the main technology done. I'd love to see that happen.
So just so we're clear here, you're stating that the industry is one test fatality away from the whole thing coming down.
Potentially. It depends, right? It depends on the circumstances.
And that there should be a separate standard for testing.
I think there should be a separate standard for testing. And I would love to see the industry just get ahead of the curve. I mean, this is an existential threat to the industry. One or more testing fatalities away from the whole industry being shut down, potentially. And I'm not trying to be alarmist, but I mean, we all saw what happened, you know, a year ago with the Uber fatality. It was the change in public sentiment was huge. And so this industry, I think this industry needs to get out in front of that. And I think that the smart way to do that is to have a standard for good, for well-behaved public road testing.
What role do you want the federal government to have in all of this, in how not just these development platforms are tested, but then ultimately deployed at a commercial scale?
I don't really care so long as the outcome works. If the industry can self-regulate, great. If they can't, they might need some help. I think that anytime you bring a heavy regulation hammer, there are certainly bad things that can happen. But the lack of any regulation at all, you know, might also be bad. So I don't have a preferred outcome other than the folks making these cars actually do safety. That's what I care about.
Based on what you know, though, or what you've seen, and you have deep insight into how these companies operate, do you think that it is possible to deploy safely with under a voluntary sort of guideline or standard, which is sort of the case now, right? There is no law that dictates on a federal level how AVs are deployed. There are some voluntary guidelines. So is the industry capable of self-regulation?
Yes, but not how they're doing it now. So let me explain. It isn't about regulation and laws. Safety is all about independent oversight, right? And it doesn't have to be the government. So right now, the thing that sets the car business apart from all the rest of the companies and businesses I've done safety for, because I've done rail, I've done petrochemical, I've done power supplies. You know, it's bad if your power supply on your laptop catches fire, right? And there's all these things, systems I've done safety for. And the thing that's different is all the rest of them have somebody independent coming in and keeping you honest. And the car business has that capability, but they don't use it for the most part. Only a few companies have external assessors come in. Typically in the past, that's not what happened. So I think to be safe, it isn't about regulation. It's about, do you have a no kidding, qualified, independent organization taking a looking over your shoulder and making sure that you actually got it safe instead of going through the motions or just waving your hands at it. Now, whether that's the government or whether that's an organization like UL, or it's some internal organization that's credibly independent, which is very hard to pull off, you know, don't really care. But I think it's about independent assessment. That's what matters. And the regulation is just one way to do it.
Well, that's probably a great way to wrap up our episode.
Can I wrap it up by asking a Tesla question?
Well, in that case, reset the clocks, 20 minutes.
No. Just a quick question, because this has come up a few times and it's something I'm interested in, and is Tesla is a unique company in that they're sort of taking this ADAS to promise of full autonomy strategy, and which is a very unlike every other AV company out there. And one of the things that Elon Musk has talked about is that they will do this and they will reach this feature complete status, but could be prevented by rolling it out by, you know, regulatory hurdles. And I'm wondering what are those regulatory hurdles? Is it a fear that there could be sudden interest in retribution, or sort of a reactionary regulation? Or is there anything that exists currently today that would prevent Tesla from taking this course of eventually launching full autonomy, which is what they promised?
All right. So I'm not a Tesla expert, but every time I hear that him say that, Elon say that, I'm like, I have no idea what he's talking about, because as long as you conform to FMVSS, you can do whatever you want.
Right.
That's the current law of the land.
Right.
Now, maybe he's talking about removing steering wheel, which is an FMVSS exemption, but you know, you can still be full autonomous with a steering wheel. So I really have no idea what he's talking about.
Okay. Well, that was my, that, no, I'm just confirming what my belief is. And And so it's great to hear that, because that I just felt like I was crazy, that I was maybe missing something.
Kirsten, what Kirsten means to say is it's great to hear that from someone other than Ed.
to be clear, I don't have an opinion whether Tesla's a good, bad, or indifferent. It's just, if somebody says, I'm worried about regulatory approval for my full self-driving car, I really have no idea which regulations they're talking about other than FMVSS. And that's all about, you know, can we pull out the steering wheel?
Yeah.
Right. And there are other things, like if there really is this intent of launching robo-taxi ride-hailing service, there are oftentimes entities within state government that regulate that. But that is a separate, that's more operational and business model that it really doesn't get to the heart of. If you have, and that actually, I wonder, you know, if that's concerning to you, not just Tesla, but for any company that currently has passenger vehicles on the road and increasing levels of automation under the ADAS qualifier, is that something that is worrisome to you? And I understand that's separate from autonomous vehicles, but Tesla certainly is one example of a company that intends to push the boundaries of ADAS. So is that something that is a problem in your view?
I think the folks that say we're going to get our ADAS perfect and then flip the autonomy switch have to think harder about safety. There's so much more to it than that. You know, part of it is that ADAS, so advanced driver assistance, this is like the automatic emergency braking and the lane keeping and all that, that's all designed so that there's a human in charge. And so you hear about setting false alarm thresholds and all that. It's if an ADAS system saves your life half the time, that's a win. But when you flip the switches and there's no human, that same ADAS system might be killing you half the time, and that's not a win. And so the roles of how ADAS works compared to autonomy are so different. It's hard for me to see how, if you had a perfect ADAS safety case, how you could just say, oh, now we're ready to self-drive. You know, partly because the design criteria are different, the optimization is different, but also because there's a human doing all these things that ADAS isn't even trying to do. You know, is the ADAS trying to make sure your kid in the baby seat in the back seat is actually buckled in before you move? Guess what? If you're sending your kid to preschool in a self-driving car, you better be paying attention. Who's getting the kid out of the car in a fire? Who's making sure that when the windshield wipers are out of fluid that you know, you can still drive? Who's making sure that the tires have been changed? And there's answers for all these things. But simply saying, oh, we have ADAS and we're flipping the switch to self-driving doesn't solve all these other higher level things that go beyond just normal driving.
I feel like this could be an entire episode, and now I'm kind of wishing we just done the whole episode like that. But I'm kidding, because this has been really, really fascinating. And we do unfortunately need to wrap it up though and let you go. But before we do, if there's a way for folks to follow your work, whether it's a social media account or a website or whatever, if you'd like to share that, I'm sure there's folks listening who'd be
It's philipkootman.teslaq.
Nice.
See, now I'm in trouble with the Tesla people, and I didn't mean to be. All right. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Phil Koopman, PhilKoopman. And I have a blog, and I have if you search my name, and it's hard not to find me. And if you can't find me, just add safety, you'll find me. So I put all my presentation slides online. All my papers are online, and usually in my Twitter feed, I sort of throw out pointers as they go online.
Great. Well, Dr. Koopman, this has been really fascinating, illuminating, and thank you so much for your time. And we'll see you all next time on another episode of the Autonicast.
But wait, don't you want to at least plug Ed? What are you working on? Where can we find you? Tweetermeyer?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Tweetermeyer. I also have my own solo podcast coming up. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to plug this, Alex, because I need to do that. It'll be out in the next week. And it is part of The Drive. It's called Merge Now. And if you keep listening to the show, I'll keep plugging it, and I'll give you more detailed information about how to subscribe then.
Kirsten?
I can be reached through various means, emails. I just read an interesting Bloomberg article that was some insane number of PR people to the ratio of PR people to reporters is something like, I don't know, 3 to 1 now.
I think it's like six to one or 7 to 1.
Something. Yeah.
Like
that. And they all have my email address. So I'm not hard to find. You can follow me on Twitter at Kirsten Korosek, and where you can read all my scoops, because
that's what you do.
That's what I do. What were you calling me before?
The irrepressible and unimpeachable authority.
I think it was Scoop Monster.
Scoop Monster.
And I had one just yesterday, by the way, so maybe you saw.
And I'd like to plug the brilliant and insightful article in The New Yorker by M.R. O'Connor, The Fight for the Right to Drive, featuring a very handsome and dashing character known as Alex Roy. A fascinating article. All right.